Talk Shoe.
Recorded live.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Talking Twilight Zone.
You maniac! You blew it up! Damn you! God damn you all to hell!
You open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination. And you're invited along. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be talking Twilight Zone.
Hello, folks. My name is Lynn. I'm your host for Talking Twilight Zone, and and once again, I am thrilled to be here with my wonderful co-host, Robert, Dave, and once again, my darling husband, Bobby, who is coming to you once again today from his hospital bed in Seattle, Washington.
Now, which song is this one from? This is 1983. We are still on hospital scene here.
Medical Center.
Nah, that was last time.
Doesn't sound familiar to me.
You, Dave?
Dr. Kildare?
No, it's Trapper John M.D. from 1980. You remember Pernell Roberts played the head of surgery
in San Francisco Hospital. Yep, Trapper John.
And his assistant was Gonzo, who had a trailer in the hospital parking lot. And played Harrison, who later on plays Logan in Logan's Run.
Right, yeah. Well, we're all here today. And as I said, Bobby is in his hospital bed, and he's thankfully here to join us for the show, and I'm going to be bringing him a wonderful meal from home tonight so he can get a break from the mundane hospital food. Of course, I'm not telling him what it is.
It's that remains to be seen. I don't know about that.
It's going to be a special surprise. Anyway, I'm just grateful. I bring him a special surprise dinner every Saturday night from home because he misses my cooking. So this is going to be special, and he doesn't know what it is, but anyway, I'm just
well, that's better than what they got at the hospital there. They got something like this.
They have this horrible pudding here. Butterscotch pudding on Mondays. It's dreadful.
It's Thursday.
Yeah, well, the pudding here is the only thing that's any good.
Oh, fantastic.
Actually, that's the truth. He says the only thing there is the pudding. Oh, I'm sorry, Ed. I didn't know you. I thought, Ed, that's right. Ed wasn't here with us last week. Bobby.
No, we missed you. Where were you, Ed?
Yeah, we missed you. He had some things going on. He couldn't be here. I'm sorry, Ed. No, Bobby's in the hospital, but it's nothing serious. Just he needs a little therapy
I'm
on his
having
leg.
Tell him the truth.
He's having what?
A lobotomy.
He's having a sex change. But he's just having some therapy on this leg, and he's probably going to be there a little while, probably another 3 weeks or so, but he's okay. He's going to survive. And yes, we are silly, but he's going to survive, and as long as I keep bringing him some meals from home, he'll survive it even better. But anyway, today's episode, it's titled One More Pallbearer, and I'm going to turn it over.
I think that's what we'll all feel after the end.
I'm going to turn it over to Robert for the opening clip.
And now, Mr. Serling.
What just looked at takes place 300 feet underground, beneath the basement of a New York City skyscraper. It's owned and lived in by one Paul Radin. Mr. Radin is rich, eccentric, and single-minded. How rich we can already perceive, how eccentric and single-minded we shall see in a moment, because all of you have just entered the Twilight Zone.
Back to you, Liz.
Thank you very much, Robert. And welcome to Ed. I'm so thrilled that Ed is here. And guest number six, I'm happy to see you here. And today's episode, one more pallbearer. Well, it's a very short summary. You've got a millionaire named Paul Radin, and he invites three people to this elaborate bomb shelter that he's built by sending a message to each of them that the meeting was a matter of life or death. So one of the people is a high school teacher, Mrs. Langford, who failed him for cheating and humiliated him for this in front of his entire class some 20 or so years ago. The second is Colonel Hawthorne, and he had him court-martialed for refusing to follow a direct order that caused the deaths of many men in his troop. And the third is Reverend Hughes, who made a public scandal out of a young woman who committed suicide over an affair that she was having with him. And Radin...
Somewhere, Lynn, there's a barroom joke somewhere, you know.
Sure there is.
A priest and school teacher and a colonel go into a bar one day, you know.
With a goat.
A weasel. Insert animal somewhere.
And Paul Radin, with the aid of these sound effects and fake radio messages, he convinces this trio of people that an apocalyptic nuclear war will occur in just moments. And he offers them refuge in the shelter if they do one thing for him, apologize for their actions. And each one of them...
Bow down, kiss his butt,
yeah. Right. And every one of them refuses. And, of course, they're valuing their honor above life and demand that Radin allow them to exit the shelter. They would rather die than spend their life in the shelter with him. And then suddenly the sound of a bomb detonating shakes Radin's shelter. And he takes the elevator to the surface, and he sees that a nuclear war really has occurred. And the world is in ruins. And the background is very similar to the background that you see in Time Enough at Last, which is kind of interesting because I think it's the same one. But this twist ending is given another twist, however, when we learn that Radin, devastated by his hoax's failure, the fact that bringing these people down here didn't give him what he wanted, he's lost his mind. And he's only imagining that the world has ended. And Radin begins sobbing helpless at the foot of this art fountain outside of his intact building while a police officer tries to comfort him and send away onlookers. And poor Paul Radin has lost his mind, is in completely an absolute mess. However, this is what happens sometimes with hoaxes. They either work out or they don't. And hey, I like a good joke as much as the next person, but some jokes, they can go a bit too far and can even be rather immature, shall we say. I mean, let's look at the scenario that's been set up in this episode. Here's a guy, he's a millionaire and possibly a multimillionaire. I mean, at the end you see that the sign on the building says the Radin Building. So he's got some serious cash. This is his place. And he's decided to use a good chunk of his wealth to set up an elaborate ruse in order to garner an apology from three people that he's held a grudge against for many, many, many years. We're talking way over 20 years. Okay, that sounds pretty stupid so far. So, and he's built a very elaborate and impressive, might I say, bomb shelter. And that much he did for real. However, he then had workers build and set up all the equipment necessary in order to stage a make-believe nuclear holocaust. Now, that doesn't just sound stupid. That sounds deranged. I mean, why in the world would a man with enough money to live the kind of life that most of us only dream about want to waste that money, and not only the money but his time, simply to fool three people who no longer mean anything to him? I mean, he's well surpassed all three of them in both wealth and status. I'm sure that most people at some time in their lives have, either felt wronged by someone or been humiliated by someone or had someone make them pay for something they did wrong, or maybe all three. And I'm sure many people, they hold grudges, but they usually don't go to the extent that Paul Radin did to get back at them or get an apology. Usually the grudge holder either stops talking to the person they're mad at, or if it's really bad, they just go slash the person's tires, you know? But they don't stage an Armageddon, for God's sake. You know, this is insane. And interestingly, Paul Raiden is of such a despicable nature that his three would-be victims have decided that being vaporized, or they thought they were going to be vaporized, is a much more pleasant fate than being sequestered in a shelter with this guy. So much for long-standing grudges, you know? Of course, Raiden's mind didn't just snap in that split second when he realized that, you know, his well-thought-out plan had failed.
Oh, his mind snapped a long time.
His mind, obviously, was on the brink of snapping for quite some time. I mean, only a nut would do what he did. I mean, the failure of his ruse was just the final marble in his mind that he needed to lose. I mean, he couldn't live with the fact that the colonel and the teacher and the reverend had negatively affected his life, and this had been slowly driving him crazy for many years. And getting an apology from him was the only way he could rest and live with himself. And it wasn't going to happen, and that was the final straw. So he did set up a pretty extreme hoax, and the civil defense announcement and the film of the nuclear explosion, they were very well done. It was a perfect example of the old saying, a mind is a terrible thing to waste. I mean, this is a guy who obviously had intelligence, but it was mixed in with a little bit of loose marbles up there. You know, if the good doctor in the shelter, that season one episode of The Shelter, had a bomb shelter the size of Raiden's, he could have fit all of his neighbors in there, a few pets, a few farm animals, you know, we all could have been in there. But, you know, it was actually quite nice and rather comfortable-looking shelter. Had a bar, a flat-screen TV, before flat-screen TVs were even imagined. And I'm sure there was plenty of food stashed away, or at least room for it. But yet when Raiden walked outside into what he imagined to be that annihilated world he thought he was seeing, I almost expected Henry Bemis to joyously run up to him and ask if he had a pair of reading glasses on him. I mean, you have to admit, the Devastation sets did look very similar, and I think they were the
Excuse
same one.
Me? Aren't you Mr. Raiden?
Yes, indeed.
Yes, Sonny, I am. Well, I'm hunting for a book. Could you help me find one here?
Give me reading glasses.
You, man. Let's go look around this Devastation and find something for you.
I need some reading glasses. This isn't fair. This isn't fair at all. You know, it's really stupid. This whole story is stupid. I mean, the whole premise is just plain dumb. You know, and also there are no supernatural fantasy elements to the story. The acting was okay. The bomb shelter was cool. And my rating is going to be a 1.5 for that alone. Decent acting. I liked the teacher. I thought the teacher was pretty cool. I mean, she just had this smirk on her face, like saying, you know, you were an idiot as a kid, and you're an idiot now, and I think you're really a piece of crap. You know, I mean, the teacher was great. But, yeah, I'm giving it a 1.5 just for the shelter, the acting, but it's very weak, very inferior, and Rod Serling's capable of much better than this. And with that in mind, I am going to turn that over to Bobby.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
Yay.
Well, actually, this is really not a bad story. It had a lot of potential. Too bad it doesn't do anything with it. Normally, I would consider this a rather intriguing episode. I like the idea, but I'm afraid it's just too preposterous to be believable, and that's where it really gets hurt. In my review, I started out by saying it has a basic problem, and that is that Serling gives the entire thing away at the beginning of the story. He shows this guy having the shelter put together. He's telling people what he intends to do, and you can see it's not real. And I think even Serling comes on and says that it's an elaborate hoax. So that takes away from any twist ending. Now, I know Serling did it because he had in his mind a better twist ending at the end, but I don't think it works. And I was put off immediately because if you're going to give most of it away, it takes a lot out of the story. I would have preferred to have been wondering whether it was real or not. I wanted to be in the position of the people he called in there to wonder if indeed he was telling the truth and if it was worth hanging around just to save yourself to be with this guy. Instead, I knew all along that, you know, and I thought that took away from the episode a lot. But I think that's only one problem with the episode. The other problem is it's just too preposterous to be believed. And it's hard to believe that those three people would sit there, even though he's built an elaborate shelter and he's got all the video and everything he needs and the sound effects and everything else. This idea that he knew there was going to be a devastating nuclear war is absurd. How would he have such knowledge? He even tells them they're going to bomb us, and we're going to bomb them, and it's the end of the world. Well, even if that ever happens one day, God forbid, it's not going to happen that way. Or we wouldn't still be sitting here 50 years later after this was filmed. Everybody knows that if anybody bombs anybody, that's the end of it. So what precipitated this? He doesn't even explain it. I mean, I can understand if it was a Cuban Missile Crisis or something like that, or there was a war one. But so one day they just decided, what did the president call up the Soviet premier and said, we're going to bomb you, like it or not? And he said to the president, we're going to bomb you, like it or not, and that's the end of the world. It's just too idiotic, and I just, it's not in any way, shape, or form believable. I know he's a millionaire, but and he's dined with kings and all of that, but where does he get that kind of information, and why in the world should I believe him at all? I'm not saying it wouldn't be scary to be down there and have him say that, but I think if you think a minute, you have to think to yourself, there's something not right about this. It just looks too screwball, and that bothered me during the episode. I just don't think those people would have believed any of it for a minute. But instead, the episode chooses to concentrate or whether they choose to die out in the open or to live with this guy who they despise. The other thing I don't like about it is that it makes no sense for him to be so obsessed over three people that wronged him in the past. Apparently, he's never heard the saying, living well is the best revenge, because he doesn't need anything from them. He's got the money, he's got the fame, he's got the power, he's got everything that anybody that arrogant would want. So why is it necessary to get the last three people? It's just not. I mean...
Well, Bobby, that's because he built his house on sand. I think that's how he came across his wealth, was to build it around that revenge of those people, which is silly to begin with.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So I just think that anybody like that would, I'm sure that Donald Trump had people in his early days before he was a multimillionaire who wronged him or didn't like him or anything like that. He's certainly not sitting around today thinking to himself, well, if I could only go back and get them to apologize to me, my life would be better.
Get that waiter spilled water on me. Yeah.
Yeah, so this guy's got what he wants. So just leave well enough alone. And I realize he's obsessed with it, but it's simply, somehow it just isn't believable. But there is a valuable lesson to be learned in this story, aside from the story itself. And that's the business about living in the past. You just don't want to live in the past. It doesn't prove anything. It doesn't get you anywhere. And if you're going to hold grudges for your entire life, the only person who's going to be hurt by that is you, because you're not going to be able to move on. I personally don't believe in that. Plenty of people have wronged me, just like everybody else, but I long ago forgot about them, and it just not worth it to just obsess over that. And as an example, I'm in the hospital right now, and last Thursday, I was on the second floor instead of where I am now, the first floor, and a doctor who's not my regular doctor was called in to look at me because they were having a problem and they wanted his advice. He blew into the room. I've never seen him before, and he was absolutely arrogant SOB. He was rude and abusive to me, and he at one point, he actually made a joke about my condition and about what he would do as a last resort if he couldn't solve it. And nobody in the room laughed, especially not me, and it was highly inappropriate to be acting
that way. I wasn't there, and I should have been there. Believe me, he wouldn't have any balls right now.
Your Dr. House. There's always a Dr. House in a hospital. I asked that when I had my heart attack last year. I said, doctors looks like him?
Well, I didn't even know they were going to call in a specialist anyway to look at me. So I was completely unaware, and... The doctor that I have here, my regular doctor who's following my case, was not around at that time. And so he was completely arrogant. And while I was rolled over to the side of the bed and he was looking at me, I reached for the phone to call Lynn. Lynn wasn't there. And not to tell her what was going on with the doctor, but simply to tell her that they called somebody else in. And he was taking a look, and he was going to give his opinion. And I reached for the phone, and he very loudly and very rudely said to me, I don't talk on the telephone. And I turned around and said, I'm not calling anybody to talk to you. I'm calling my wife, if you don't mind. And I mean, this went on for about 5 minutes or so, and it was absolutely preposterous. I don't know what was with him.
I wish I had been there. Because that guy would be talking in a very high voice right now.
But the reason I bring this up is because Lynn and I have discussed this, and Actually, we both reported him to the highest people in the hospital, who assured us that he would be or will be reprimanded. Whether that really happened or not, I don't know. But I said, if he comes in my room again, people ask me, what are you going to do if he comes in now that you're on the first floor? And my answer is nothing. I will simply say to him, hello, doctor, how are you today? And the reason for that is because I don't believe in that kind of stuff. I don't believe in holding any grudges, or even when it's just a week later or whatever it turns out to be. Because it really doesn't go anywhere. I mean, if he wants to apologize to me, he'll simply walk in and do it. If I have to ask him for it, or if I have to say to him, like this guy did in this episode, you wronged me at one time, and now I want you to get down on your knees and beg my forgiveness, it isn't worth it. It's not worth it if I have to force him to do it. So what's the point? So I don't really believe in that kind of thing. And I thought about that when Lynn and I were watching this episode last night, and I thought to myself, it's really a waste of time to do that. It's a waste of time to go on the past. For me, in my stay in this hospital, the only revenge I want is simply to get out of here and go back and pick up the pieces of my life after this idiotic experience.
I'm not letting him get away with that. I mean, I reported the guy.
I don't have any problem with reporting him.
I hope to God he walks in your room again. I hope he walks in your room again, because I have a lot to say to him.
Just like these people in the story did not apologize like they were told to do, he's not going to do it either.
I don't expect him to, but I'm going to let him know that I think of him. I'm going to let him know that I think he's a major... You know what? He's a major
idiot. My point in bringing this up as regards this episode is just that there's really no point in it. If this guy, what was he going to do? Suppose they had apologized to him. I mean, this is what he had to go through in order to get them to apologize. I mean, honestly, it's just not worth it. It's not worth it at all. And it's an example of how you wreck your own life if you carry that around all of your days. If you're just angry and you never get over it. You'll just destroy your own life. The people, whoever did wrong to you, no matter how bad it was, they're going to go on with their life, and they're not going to care one way or the other, but you're the one who's going to pay for it. And that's obvious in this story, and I think it's a lesson to be learned, because he had everything going for him, and there was no point in him going back and demanding that these people come in and do this. Beyond that, I just like I said, I think the episode is just too unlikely. That's all. Now, if I had been one of the people brought in there, sure, I would have been scared to death if some guy standing there telling me that the world's going to end and he's giving me a chance to save myself. But I would hope that I would be calm enough to at least question him and say, how is it you've come upon this knowledge? It just doesn't add up. It just doesn't add up that suddenly there's going to be a nuclear war and only he is going to survive. Also, I didn't like the ending either. The ending with him simply having lost his mind and sees around him destruction is interesting, but I would have preferred for him to come up top and see that there really was a nuclear war. But it just so happens that it actually took place, that it wasn't set up by him. I know everybody else would have died. I'm sorry about that, but I thought that would have been a more fitting ending for him. It's not good enough for him just to be carted off to a mental hospital because he might get out of there one day. I thought a more fitting ending, I mean, if poor Henry Bemis could end up that way, then he should have too. And there should have been really total destruction around him. Like I said, I think it's an interesting episode. I like the concept. It's one of those episodes that probably looks better on paper than it does on the screen. If it just wasn't so far-fetched and so unbelievable, I might have gone for it. I gave it a 1. I think it is a poor episode, and I'm really sorry about that. The acting is good. You've got some really good actors in there. Certainly Joseph Weissman, you've got some great actors in there. But you've got a story that's just, after about 10 minutes, it just becomes laughable, and you just can't believe it. So I'll stick with my 1. I think it is a very poor story. Lynn?
Okay. And Ron's here. Thanks for coming, Bear Fan Ron, who's put us on Gamut Radio. Thank you so much for that, Ron. We really appreciate it. And also, I just want to make sure, Ron, do you have a site for Gamut Radio that you could put into the chat room? I know it's probably in that email you sent me, but Dave was asking about it as well, and I'd sure like to... You know, have it up here if you could.
Well, I put it in before the recording started.
Oh, I'm
what
sorry.
I believe
yes,
to be the
you
right
did.
One.
It's the same one. I apologize. You're right. No, Dave did. Thanks, Ron. No, Dave did put it in. I'm sorry, Dave. Yeah, Dave did put it in. FGRN.net. Sorry. Okay, that's my
yeah,
senior.
Yeah, right
moment.
Now on the station, we're running the beginning of season 3. He should be up to number 68, episode 68, which is The Shelter. And
okay,
then I just
cool.
sent him the the passerbys this week.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, Dave did put it up, and I apologize. I forgot that he has the same thing up there. That's my senior moment for the day. Okay. All right. And so now, and I'm going to send this over to Robert, and you can start doing your senior moments there. Okay.
Yeah, I think this is the one where majority of us are in agreement with this episode. But, you know, to get started on. Wait, what's going on? Oh, come on. We're in the middle of freaking show here. Hello? Wow, long time. You know I'm in the middle of show here, huh? Oh, yeah, I guess I could fit you in. Let me get you on speakerphone here. Ladies and gentlemen, believe it or not, Mr. Horse.
No, sir. I didn't like it.
Well, thank you, Mr. Horse. Let me get you a call back later on. I'll bring you some notes over. Thanks a lot.
That's great.
There we go. Okay. Where to start with this? Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that's where I'm starting it right there. Dave, always like to say where
are you losing it, Robert? Are you losing it, Robert?
Now I'm making a reference to you, Dave. How you always keep talking about the two bites of cherry. I think Rod had four bites of the cherry with this one because this is kind of a hodgepodge of different episodes from different seasons thrown together. Like have The Shelter with the emergency broadcast alert that was used in that, and then we're mentioned about Time Enough at Last and. I mean, the real question about this
also
episode,
reminded me of this. It also reminded me of The Silence as well.
Mm-hmm.
The one where
he was
to win the bet. He does that mm-hmm. thing with his throat. Yeah.
I agree. As it says, it's a hodgepodge of everything thrown together. Now the question becomes, you know, what would I do with all the millions I made? I certainly would find a better use than using it for a, you know. Now even though I would say it's a fake theater shelter. I mean, the way he said it was a functioning shelter with just the special effects added in. Decide to do revenge on a school teacher, a colonel, and a minister. It's like I said to Bobby. I said maybe this was something that he had interwove together on his, you know, ascent of the wealth that he made. And it's kind of silly. You know, I mean, you see what happens at the very end when it just all falls in like a house of cards. Just nothing left, and now, you know, you have all these millions, and you get to pay the doctors and the hospital to take care of you. I mean, you should have done, you know, what you were doing, which was traveling, as the teacher suggested. He probably did go to places, and you're a millionaire. Get over it. Do all the things that you want to do, you know, go on skiing trips and stuff like that. You know, get over the pettiness of the past. I mean, it's very emo-y. Again, another emo character, as in the Tall Wish, where, you know, you got to believe, you got to believe, you know, that with that, you know, messed up kid that the boxer mixed with. It's just not that great of an episode. And I mean, even using the stock, I mean, you know, we use stock music in the other episodes as well, but actually taking the music from The Invaders, you know, excellent music by Jerry Goldsmith, and putting it on this piece of crap is just too bad. No.
I agree with that.
Yeah. Okay, let's do a little comparison here, okay? Time Enough at Last. Brilliant. Middle part of the show heading towards the end where. And I think it's a first for Serling to do narration as he's, you know, Bemis is walking through the devastation.
Seconds, minutes, hours. They crawl by on hands and knees for Mr. Henry Bemis, who looks for a spark in the ashes of a dead world. A telephone connected to nothingness. A neighborhood bar, a movie, a baseball diamond, a hardware store. The mailbox of what was once his house and is now a rubble. They lie at his feet as battered monuments to what was but is no more.
Helen! Helen! Where are you?
Mr. Henry Bemis on an 8-hour tour of a graveyard.
And instead you get this.
Hey, Mac. Mac. That a little bit too much? Hey, Mac.
I didn't want it this way.
Let me take you home, Mac.
I didn't want it this way. No. Somebody, please.
Mac.
Anybody, won't somebody listen to me?
Even Henry
now,
kept...
Now, Dave, he did sound like Dr. No in that scene, so...
Even Henry kept it together better than Raiden did. At least Henry was able to keep a little bit of the sanity there.
I mean, just the twist of it being in the mind, okay, I granted that something there, but it just a mangled mess of other stories from the past seasons where it just totally brings... And I mean... It don't seem any better on the next one we review, too. So you know what I'm talking about with that one. But unfortunately, the only thing I could... there's a lot of revenge type where, you know, Revenge is a series that's run on ABC where I hadn't really watched very much of it, but about this woman comes back, take revenge on what happens to her in her life. And, I mean, you know, we can even go all the way back to Dallas where... We have revenge scenarios running through there. There was one I trying to remember. It wasn't Happy Birthday to Me. It was one of the ones that had the girl from Little House on the Prairie who played Mary, who was blind.
Oh, yeah. And, Melissa Sue Anderson.
Yeah, she was in a horror movie where she was killing all these people that wronged her. The only thing I could think of was Matinee, and I mentioned Matinee when we did The Shelter, and even Bobby brought up the Shelter on this, which is basically John Goodman playing a William Castle type person playing Woolsey, and he comes up with the special effects for this big man-ant or mantis or whatever they call the movie he's taking around to the theaters during the Cuban Missile Crisis. So here's the trailer for that.
How could such a thing happen, Dr. Gravel?
The ant's saliva must have gotten into Bill's bloodstream and gone straight to his brain, just as the radiation, which is measured in units called Rentgens, was released.
And that's how he became a...
Mant.
Gotcha.
For the kids of Key West, Florida, there was nothing scarier than a monster matinee.
Lawrence Woolsey, the master of movie horror, exterminates you with Mant.
The story of Mant is based on scientific fact, on theories that have appeared in national magazines.
But in the fall of 1962...
A series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on the island of Cuba.
They got the biggest scare of all.
The bombers?
The country is on red alert.
And what a perfect time to open a new horror movie.
That'd be the best show to take us girls here.
The whole world's gonna blow up anyway, so we should just do whatever we want.
You know, last guy she went out with in the farm school?
He did teach me a lot.
What about?
About my body.
Think of the bomber about to fall, she'd do it with me.
Wait till you see the feelers on this thing.
Uno, dos, one, two, tres, cuatro.
Some of it's stage lighting, some of it's magic show stuff, but the big studios, none of them have anything like it.
Never, ever turn one above six.
This is it!
From Joe Dante, director of Gremlins.
You see what he's putting back? The showmanship.
The bombs are falling!
You think this is some kind of picnic for me?
Well, I'm still concerned about that bomb thing.
Little question of taste?
No, but your younger patrons, you could have some seat wetness.
John Goodman.
I love this business.
Matinee.
Man, I've seen this twice.
And I have seen that movie. It is kind of funny. I like John Goodman in that role. It also had Robert Picardo, if you remember him. He played the hologram doctor in Star Trek Voyager. He plays the theater manager in this one. And then we have where they're showing the movie, Matt, the guy in the beginning that was telling about the radiation stuff. He appears later on in the Twilight Zone, the movie, in the It's a Good Life segment where he plays the father in that section. So, but yeah, pretty much a 1.5 out of 5 I give for this one. Very disappointed in that.
What did you give it?
1.5.
Okay.
Just like you. Poor Bobby. I think he's probably the same one out of all of us out of this episode. I'm going to pass it over to Dave.
Okay. Yes, another one I thought it reminded me of as well, Robert, was The Midnight Sun. You remember? The one where the person is deluded that the Earth is getting hotter and hotter. And
then the twist at the end, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I didn't think it was as bad as that, but it was definitely a disappointment. It had a lot of promise, and it had obviously those flaws. I mean, I think we have to just differentiate about the fact that it was a made-up shelter, because it wasn't. Obviously, it was really a shelter. It was really 300 feet down, and it was a shelter. The flaw thing about it was the fact that he'd got the workmen to do the, you know, the fake alarms going off and the fake video and so on. But it actually was a real shelter that presumably a millionaire in the 60s would have probably felt was a desirable thing to have, you know, to save himself in the event of such an event. And so the actual, it wasn't really a joke. He only passed it off as a joke to the workmen because they would think, you know, why is this guy watching films at the end of the world? You know, is he a sicko or something? And so he was passing it off to them that it was really just an elaborate practical joke. But of course, it was a deception to get these people to apologise to him and so on. Now, one of the things that wasn't clear here to me was what would he have done if they had indeed have submitted to his desires and made the apology.
I thought about that too. What was he going to do from there?
Basically, that's almost calling his bluff, because is he then going to say, right, we're all going to stay in here for 5 years, we've got to eat food, and as you said, Lynn, a millionaire man who can have everything that life has to offer, you know, caviar, fancy cars, this, that and the other, would he spend 5 years in life with people that he obviously despises because they did say it? I mean, you could almost have done with a scene where there was a mirror in the room and he's talking into the mirror. Mirrors are used an awful lot in Twilight Zone, ways, you know, where he imagines them. Perhaps they could have shown them in the mirror, not in the room, but before they arrive, shown them in the mirror, you know, apologising to him, and then him then sort of throwing it back in the faces and casting them out or whatever, and saying, well, Vicar, I'm going to have you defrocked. Colonel, I'm going to have you, you know, demobbed from the army by some scandal. And the teacher, you know, I'm going to have your pension docked because I'm going to do, you know, tell the school board something about you. But they didn't do that. So, in effect, all he was going to do was punish himself by sticking himself in this shelter for 5 years. The other thing that was rather strange, I mean, he has got all this millions of money. What does he have hanging in the room? A bloody cardboard mobile. I mean, if I was him, you know, I would have had, you know, Michelangelo, well, you know, Leonardo's Mona Lisa on one wall.
The Sistine Chapel painted on the shoulder.
I would have had
Rembrandt sitting all around.
Gauguin's sunflowers on the other. You know what I mean? Because, of course, we know now that even if he was a multimillionaire, 3 or 4 million, he couldn't afford, Van Gogh's sunflowers. He couldn't afford it because it's like $80 million it's worth. But the point is, in the 60s, you could probably have bought it for $500,000. So you would have thought he would have had it set out really as a place that one could survive and entertain oneself. You would have had a book full of a wall full of shelves of, you know, all the finest reading material and so on. So it definitely looked as though the reason for this episode was not so much the intriguing nature of the way the denouement was going to go ahead, but almost, and I'm sure Robert will know what I mean, that this was basically a cheap bottle episode, because it all took place in one room with concrete walls, with a child's cardboard mobile hung up in a corner.
That represents what he really is, Dave. He's actually a child. He never grew up, like the school teacher said.
Well, no,
they don't indicate that he's married or anything. There's no indication that this man has any family or a wife or children that he cares about, because probably no one can stand this guy. He's probably one of the most arrogant, obnoxious people alive.
A modern-day Scrooge is what he is.
No, I don't think he's a modern-day Scrooge, because you see him come in and he's got a long cigarette holder type thing, a bit affected. He's wearing like what they call a smoking jacket or whatever, with a cravat round his name. So he's obviously a man who likes to wear like silk near to himself, and he's obviously not going to wear sackcloth and ashes for 5 years in that place. So you would have thought he would have surrounded himself with, you know, objet d'art and paintings and sophisticated things. In fact, if I was him, why bring your enemies? Why not invite the three most educated people you could find in America? You know, bring some sort of literary person you admire, or some actress that you admire, or some intellectual, and offer them that. So basically, once you start analyzing it,
Bobby said...
Well,
he could have fit
a wine
cellar in there, Dave, and had classiest of wines in there, yeah.
Yeah, but the whole point is, once you actually... On the face of it, I quite enjoyed it in some ways, but the denouement was suspect. The closer you examine it, the more it falls apart in your hands. Now, I do want to mention a few things that haven't been mentioned. Just again, I don't like to do an episode and date check for the people who don't follow, you know, on the Yahoo forums and may not have all these things to hand. So this was season 3, episode 82, aired on the 12th of January, 1962. And it was only in October 62 that Dr. No aired, the first James Bond film, of course, which Joseph Wiseman played Dr. No. So presumably he was actually filming that almost the very next thing he did after doing this. So basically they couldn't have afforded him 6 months later, because that was his breakout movie. The first thing I ever saw him in, although not contemporary at the time, I saw him in it recently, was a very good film called Detective Story with Kirk Douglas and William Bendix. And I think it's the first acting role that Joseph Wiseman had.
Oh, I've seen that movie. I didn't know Joseph Wiseman was in that.
Yeah, he played a two-bit criminal was brought in for questioning, because in that, and that's basically a stage play type of detective story. It all takes place in the actual building, and Kirk Douglas is dealing with about six cases at once and all sorts of things. A bit of a heavy-handed crook, but this Joseph Wiseman. This was 10 years earlier, November 1951. He's one of these method actors. He's sort of straight out of, the film Giant and... what the hell's his name? It's just escaped me now. You know, the James Dean type of acting. Really very strange acting indeed. And again, somebody like William Bendix, who was so marvellous, and... Kirk Douglas, he stood apart as this sort of young generation of actors. But I just found that, as a historic note, an interesting thing. What else? A little bit of notes. Not really, I think. I think basically it had the premise of a good story. It was a reused idea, rehashed, as Robert said. I think the actual tight containment of that air raid shelter should have brought better work from Rod Sterling. It definitely does not hold water once you start to analyse it. And I like Bobby's answer. I think really you didn't, basically, I think the idea was it was a double trick, wasn't it? The first trick was that when he comes up, we're led to believe that the bomb really did go off. And then we have the second trick that, no, it didn't. His mind is just gone. I think it would have been better sticking with the first premise. And actually, it had been a fluke that the actual event had happened just at the point he was playing the trick. Basically, the cry wolf syndrome. You know, if you cry wolf, nobody believes you. And then when it really happens, it's too late because the warning goes unheeded. So concept-wise, I would have given it a 3. Execution, probably give it a 2.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think, the better ending, I think, would have been if the nuclear holocaust had actually happened. And, but there, it was like a double twist ending. And I guess in Ron's mind, that was the best way to do it. But I think it's better the way you said, just have it, have the holocaust. And I think that would have been cool. But,
I wanted to ask you guys, did those, the repair guys in there, didn't they look like the actors from the Dead End Kids? Remember the Dead End Kids?
Oh, yeah.
That one guy has his hat back and the other one that's in the background. Now, I tried to hunt that actor up to I was hunting that actor up to see if he did appear in those Dead End movies, and I guess he didn't, but, I mean, man, he looked awful familiar.
Didn't he, the one guy that was there the most of them, who was actually talking to him and was looking behind when he was... I even said to Bobby, I said, this guy looks so familiar. I've seen... I think he may have even been in another Twilight Zone episode. I'm not sure, but he looked very, very familiar. He, the real, real dopey-looking guy, yeah. Yeah, he...
Yeah.
I've seen him before. So, Ed, what do you think?
Well, first of all, hello, everybody. How you doing?
Hello.
Hi, Ed. Welcome back.
Hey, Ed.
I wasn't here last week. And,
Ed's our norm.
Yeah,
norm.
We had an incident at our house. And Norm, like, oh, cheers.
We thought you weren't here last week because I screwed up and got the time wrong. I actually scheduled the show for 6 a.m. instead of 6 p.m.
So, another senior moment, yeah.
Yeah, one of my other senior moments. So I didn't know, maybe that's why you weren't here and I felt bad.
I worry about myself now. I'm only 37 and I'm having senior moments already, so don't feel bad. All right.
Oh, gee.
Anyway. He's the youngest guy here. Oh, shut up, Ed.
All right. Well, let's see. First of all, I love Bear Fan Ron's comment. I give it a 2 because it's poo. I got to remember that. That's a good quote. It's
I didn't see that. I expect Ron to write.
All right, let's see. Well, this was actually an episode that I had never seen before, which was to me was like, wow, that's great. I was looking forward to seeing it, And the premise sounded interesting. And as others had mentioned, it had the seed of a good story, but nobody watered it and kind of withered quickly for me, I love the premise. It sounded good in text, but as I'm watching it, the characters actually just annoyed me. Raiden's character is meant to be annoying. He's meant to be unlikable. Okay, I get that. He's smug. He's annoying. It's how the writers wanted him. But then I don't know, Colonel Hawthorne. He was just blah. The Reverend there, Hughes, was just kind of disinteresting. And only slightly interesting character was Mrs. Langford.
I loved her. I thought she was great. Yeah.
She was.
I was just going to jump in. I thought she was quite good as an actress, but the last scene that she delivered in the lift, I thought was a bit deadpan. She seemed to be almost saying it in a trance. I thought she tailed off a little bit there.
She did. As a matter of fact, I said that she went on a little long there. They were trying to get out into that elevator and get going, and I was like, okay, just go,
Yeah. Well, the actors were doing, I think, a good job with what they were given, but it was just, to me it was, okay, so they were trying to make a point that all these people had family that they cared about so much that they'd rather die with them than, stay alive down there with Raiden. And that I got, but, I mean, if I was in their shoes, I'd want to know, okay, I think I want to know, how do you know the world's ending? I want to know everything about it, Who is it that's doing this? Why? And how are you sure? And I mean, I would ask a million questions. I think they just kind of accepted it too easy. And then I think what took away from it, I think I think Bobby touched on this one, and it's I know they had to explain the backstory with the electronics installation guys or handyman or whatever you want to call them, explaining as much as they did, showing, you know, the whole time, you know, that the whole thing is set up and that he's got this video ready and these sound effects ready. And that the whole time he's just playing mind games with these people. And it just, I mean, I hated Raiden, which they intended. And I didn't really feel bad for the three other characters as much as I think the writers wanted you to, you know? So I find myself
not so much Joseph Wiseman as the actor. I he's a great actor. And it's just the role and the concept of the story. I mean, like you said, it's a good concept, but it just fell apart. Because it's all different episodes from different seasons all thrown together.
Exactly.
Yeah, I guess that's what it is. It was a mishmash of other things. But I found myself watching four characters that I didn't really like, you know, which was a shame. Because it could have been really good. And the twist of the bomb actually exploding, and then a twist again of the fact that he was actually living inside of his head, it just didn't work for me. And it did make me wonder if they were trying to say that the whole thing, including the scenario with the guest, was real at all, because did he imagine everything? You know, seeing as how the sculpture on the outside, the front of the building, was the exact same sculpture as in the bunker, did he imagine the bunker too? Were they ever down there? I don't know. I mean, I guess you could look at that as, you know, good writing, or I don't know, or just confusing writing. I don't know. I ended that episode by wondering how quickly I could press the button to get to the next episode. So,
oh, don't be in such a hurry for the next one.
Yeah, really. Exactly.
I haven't looked at what it is yet.
Well, I think the colonel at one point did say, you know, how do you know this, Raiden? How do you know anything about this? And I forget what his exact answer was, but something about I have my sources or something like that. He couldn't give a clear cut answer because he knew it was a hoax. And the colonel was the only one who asked. But to be honest, I don't know why they went there to begin with. You know, they said that they each got a message saying that they needed to show up at his bunker or at his building because it was a life or death situation. I don't care. You know what?
Whoa. When a millionaire tells you that, you think, oh, hang on, I might be a distant relative of his. It might be the weakling of the will.
But that would be pretty far. I mean, really, life or death situation. You got to give me more information than that. Yeah. Somebody I haven't seen in over 20 years, and you know they're going to tell me like, what?
Tell me
could
long lost cousin, third in the line from.
Have you ever seen 10 Little Indians? I mean, the old film.
Yeah, well, I guess, but you probably still have to give me a little bit more information. I mean, to just go there under a premise of life or death, I haven't seen this guy in over 20 years, what could he possibly want or need from me, you know? And it just sounded kind of silly, but, yeah, I agree with Ed and everyone else. It just fell apart. It's, you know, what do you give it, Ed? What would your rating be on it?
It's not the worst one I've ever seen, so I won't give it a one, but it's it's not quite up to a two, so I'd say one and a half. Yeah, 1.5. I agree on that.
Tough crowd.
Yeah. I know.
Very tough. Nobody's
well,
giving
over
it.
On our site, we give there was four ones, and me and you gave 1.5. Mm-hmm. There was two there was three for two. No one gave it a lousy, which is kind of surprising. We have 2 for 2.5, and then we have one that gave it a 3. And that was about as far as it went.
Well, Truth Radio's put in the room as well, remember?
Oh, yeah, Truth Freedom, yeah. Truth Freedom, by the way, Truth Freedom, no, you can't get these on YouTube. You used to be able to watch them on YouTube, but unfortunately, the creeps at CBS, the powers that be, who are horrible creeps, have decided that they don't want people to be able to watch them on YouTube. So they, at one point, took any episodes that were on YouTube and they cut out the middles of them. So you can watch part one and you can watch part three of any episode, but they ripped the whole middles out.
There's a place that you can go to watch it called www.tubeplus.me. You go to that site, and they have all the seasons of Twilight Zone so far.
Really? Wait.
Yep.
Right. Well, this particular episode I saw there on a site called Flyby or something, FLIBY, and I managed to watch it there.
All right. Okay, now I'm getting some good information here. www.tubeplus.me.
Yep,
all right. Yep. Okay. Okay. Truth Freedom. I hope you got that one. www.tubeplus.me, because YouTube took all the middles out of all of them. Anything that CBS has to do with, they take all the middles out, because God forbid they should, lose a dollar. They're in such dire straits.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. But yeah, this is great too. And Babe, what was the one you mentioned?
The one up in the room. It's FLIBY.com, and it was in one complete piece, and they look as though they have a few others, bits and pieces from Twilight Zone there. So I watched the whole thing through.
All right, so I got them both down now. All right, Bobby, we've got an alternate choice of watching these episodes other than me bringing the DVDs to the hospital. So this
I don't know how many others they have on that site, but I managed to watch that one.
Fantastic. All right. Well, I appreciate all that information.
And I typed it in the chat. It does work. Just when you go to search, type in the Twilight Zone, and it should come right up.
Fantastic.
So, and that's it for today's show. Thank you for listening to Talking Twilight Zone. Be sure to tune in on August the 4th. That'll be the next show. And our episode for that show will be Dead Man's Shoes. That is episode 83 of Twilight Zone. And again, thank you for listening from Lynn and Dave and Bobby and everybody. Take care, and we'll talk to you later. Goodbye, everybody.